dit was hier ook in de 40's van de kans op de VEI, samenwerking van de kans op ja. Aan de BM kant bijvoorbeeld. You don't send an apology on the day of the meeting. That it deals with your legislation. And I am going to ask that you phone your executive director and tell him that we expect him to be at tomorrow's meeting. We can't have a situation where they then in the end turn around and say the committee didn't hear from him. That is why they are supposed to be here. When we drop legislation on the police, the people who are responsible for that environment are there throughout the whole process. And that is what we expect as well. Not disregarding your own presence here, but in the end you are not the executive director. Mr. Ntuli is here on behalf of the council, so that's fine. But I am not happy with the absence of the executive director of CIRA. I've also received the meetings of the technical committee. Members will remember that I asked last week that they keep record of all the meetings that they have of the technical committee so that we can monitor the presence of those people involved there. And again, there we have the same situation where the council and the executive director are absent in those meetings. Now, we're not paying for somebody's air ticket and for their hotel accommodation if they're not here to work. Simple as that. The technical team must be informed by CIRA on many of the issues. And it's no use CIRA complaining afterwards if they're not participating in the process. So I will... Secretary, is the minister back yet? Back on Thursday. I'll write a letter to the minister in this regard as well. It's just not on. Can we continue? I've got things that were outstanding in 42, page 42. The exemption from the Government Gazette. Publishing of it in the Government Gazette. You're saying we're going to 46.
Chair, we left off on paragraph BA on page 46 of the draft of today. What we have done, we have made all the amendments on one document because we've been working from different documents. So, Chair, we can start on that page or we can just continue from here and then start from scratch again.
The reason why I'm asking this is because you will remember before we stopped, there were other issues that were not covered. And I don't know whether we shouldn't go back to. That's why I've got 42, page 42. That we can go back there and that we start there, please. I don't know where it is in today's document. You can just indicate to us where it is in today's document.
Chair, on... it was just before section 17 on page 42, and in today's document, it is page 41. Chair, the committee asked that we should look at the issue of monthly and quarterly report in terms of the Public Finance Management Act to the Minister and the number of meetings of the Council. Chair, we have redrafted that. To read, that's on page 41 of the new version. Sub 3, the Minister must table in Parliament a copy of the annual report, financial statements and the audit report on those statements as required by the Public Finance Management Act. Then we've inserted sub 4, the director must publish, including on a medium accessible to the public, the annual report, financial statements and audit report on those statements once tabled in Parliament.
Members, are we satisfied with that? Can I just ask, on a medium, that for me looks like electronic only.
make it in the medium chair.
I think so. That we cover the possibility of newspapers or whatever. Continue then.
Thank you, Chair. Then section 17, 18 and 19 are then deleted from the Act because they relate to the issues of the Public Finance Management Act, which will now regulate the authority. Chair, on page 43, there were no new amendments. Chair, if I can just explain, we have taken out all the different colors and things to make it easier for reference. So the parts that we've marked with the yellow background are the issues that we have to come back to, that the committee hasn't dealt with previously. But all the text that's been changed is still in red font. So if the committee would want to go back to one of those issues, we can do it. But the proposal is that we focus on the issues that are marked with a yellow background. Chair, the first issue then is on page 44, subsection 5. The Minister may, after taking into consideration, Chair, it just seemed to me there's two afters there we need to take out. I would propose the one after the square brackets, if we take that after out. The Minister may, after taking into consideration the recommendations of the Exemption Advisory Committee referred to in section 28, by notice in the Gazette, exempt any security service provider or security service provider belonging to a category or class specified in the notice, either generally or subject to such conditions as may be specified in the notice, from the operation of any of the provisions of this Act, and B, service, activity, practice, equipment, person or entity from any provision of this Act, as long as it does not prejudice the achievement of the objects of this Act.
Can I hear you on that one? Satisfied? Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. The next amendment is where we actually stopped last time. I think I will just refer to the start of the section on page 45 in section 21.1. An application for registration as a security service provider must be made to the authority in the prescribed manner and must be accompanied by. And then I'll continue with B, Chair, the application fee as determined by the Council, and B, a certified copy of a valid identity document of the person referred to in paragraph A, B, a design, sketch or photograph of the security service provider's insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on a uniform, vehicle or otherwise, and B, C, a color sketch or photograph of the security service provider's uniform. Chair, you will recall that the BC was not included in the previous text.
This, does that cover our concerns we had previously about the uniforms not being scrutinized? It seems so. Can we continue then?
Thank you, Chair. On page 47, Chair, the committee has asked us to insert the categories of security businesses. We proposed section 21.1. The authority may register a security business meeting the requirements in sections 21 and 23 under any one or more of the following categories. A, guarding. B, close protection. C, response security. D, assets in transit. E, event security. F, manufacturers, importers, and distributors of listed equipment defined in the interception of communications and provision of communication-related information. Act, gee, I think the Act must be inserted after information. Act number 70 of 2002. G, private investigators. H, security training. I, electronic security. J, locksmiths. Or K, security advisors. Then subsection 2, the Minister may, by notice in the Gazette, determine additional categories of security businesses. 3, the authority must determine training standards in respect of subsection 1. 4, a notice referred to in subsection 2 must be tabled in Parliament for notification.
Minister, can I hear you on this, Honourable Stuber?
Thank you, Chair. Just want to know, the close protection, do we meet, we mean the people that do VIP protection also?
That's correct, Chair.
Honourable Global?
Jefferson, what is the response security?
Research?
Oh, C. C, Chair. Chair, it's basically security like we have in our homes where an alarm goes off and they immediately have to respond to the alarm.
On Global.
Jefferson. Now, before, a notice referred to subsection 2 must be tabled in Parliament for notification. When? So the chairperson will understand the background where you are coming from when you say the minister must issue this notice. When?
We'll just check. There are numerous instances of reporting to Parliament. We will just align the wording with that to link a period that is generally used.
Honourable Gitter.
Thanks, sir. I agree with the Honourable Grove. What is the security advisors? Can you probably detail that?
Thanks, sir.
Sir Jacobs?
It's normally advisors that would look at the business or enterprise and see what are the gaps and what type of security in terms of physical security, information security, etc., need to be taken in order to decide, and is normally also related to the costs involved. So normally there's a number of options given to the company in terms of what is the level of security that they need and what is affordable, etc.
In-house security, are we capturing that? For instance, a mining company having its own security company, not using another security company.
As I understand, these are the categories that must be registered.
I think my question is more basic. With these categories, will it mean that, for instance, A, the BS, who's got its own security arm, have to register with CIRA? I think that's the important question.
Chair, the earlier in the Act it refers to in-house security, so they are covered, but they would also have to register their guarding section as those different sections within their in-house.
Honourable Molibachi?
Chairperson, will this include CIT?
Yeah, I think that's the assets one. Assets in transit.
Yes, Chair, the assets asset in transit, and it's also covered in the definitions, Chair.
That brings me to the other question. Are all these things now covered in definitions? Most probably will have to. You will probably have to look at that. What is guarding service? What is close protection? Might be a section that we need extra in the definitions. Can I hear you on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it's really necessary. You know, even if we look at the legislation that's already in force, not in force but adopted on the mercenary issues, basically the same list is also in that act without definitions for each and every one. I think that the normal dictionary meaning will pertain to this. And I think most of them, if we look at issues like private investigators, etc., are already covered. But we can look and see whether there's problematic ones that would need some explanation and then insert definitions on them, Jay.
That you do that for us. I'm comfortable with your answer, but just check for us that we make sure about it, please. If they're all problematic ones, if we can include them in the definitions. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 48, renewal of registration.
Chair, you will recall that the committee asked us to look at the necessity and also to have some discussion on this issue. Chair, what we decided in view of the advantages that was given to the committee on the renewal, we think it would be wise to actually retain this section in the Act. So once the capacity of CIRA is such that renewal can be done, that it can be done, and we will also address this in the transitional provisions to ensure that there is no obligation in terms of regulations in this regard until the policy decision is made. But here we also propose to make a number of amendments in this section. 22, to insert a subparagraph 1 that reads, the Minister may prescribe procedures in respect of the renewal of registration by registered security providers and the conditions and requirements for the granting of such applications. 2A, the registered security service provider must apply for the renewal of the relevant category of registration within the period determined by the Minister by notice in the Gazette. B, different periods may be determined in terms of paragraph A in respect of different categories of security businesses for registration. And Chair, this relates to an incremental implementation of that section. C, if an application for the renewal of registration has been lodged within the period contemplated in subsection 2, the registration remains valid until the application is decided. This is very the same as with the Firearms Control Act. Sub 3, an application for renewal of registration contemplated in subsection 1 must, in addition to any requirement in terms of this Act, be accompanied by A, a certified copy of the existing registration certificate, and B, such other information as may be prescribed. We will correct that typo there, Chair. And for the registration of any security service provider who fails to apply for the renewal of registration before the end of the period determined by the Minister in terms of subsection 2, lapses, subject to compliance with section 265.
Hear you on this section. My first question would be in terms of 22.1. The Minister may prescribe procedures. The Minister must regulate. Regulations must be, you know, I want us to move away from the word prescribe procedures and get to regulations. And are we in agreement, members, that it must be a must? Should be a must. Happy? Seems like that. Can we take that in consideration? Is there anything else under the section, members? You would remember we had a long discussion on this issue, talking about the advantages, disadvantages of having renewals.
Chairperson, can John elaborate on 4, the last paragraph? Can you elaborate that? What does it mean?
So it means that if the Minister has determined a certain date within which renewal must take place and a security service provider has not applied for that renewal as provided in the notice within that period that has been stipulated by the Minister, then at the end of that period the registration will lapse. In other words, the person will not be able to continue with his business unless he makes an application from scratch. But it is to really enforce the idea of renewal.
Can I hear you, Honourable Ndlovu? Are you happy with that explanation?
Yeah. Chairperson, I'm a little bit covered because of the period you determined. That's where I'm a little bit covered because I use my hand because I wanted to know it's within the period, not outside the period.
Madam Chair, I'm happy with it, but probably somewhere. Probably somewhere we'll have to deal with how do we implement this section, because that is where there's been a big failure. That's why there are so many unregistered security companies in the country. So many unregistered security officers. That's why I'm saying I'm happy with this. I hope somewhere we're going to deal with the implementation of this. Because if we put it like this and there's no properly crafted implementation, it's going to be just words written in this paper.
Commissioner Jacob has also indicated that they will address some of these issues in the transitional arrangements as well. But I think it's, I want to come in with the Honourable George on this issue, that we need to, with something that we didn't do in the beginning in the Firearms Control Act, later on we did do it, the obligation of CIRA to complete these applications within a certain period of time to communicate the administrative justice type of obligation on CIRA as well. Otherwise, it's again a one-sided approach where we put the emphasis on the service providers, the security service providers, but there's no obligation on the authority to actually execute. Honourable Ndlovu?
No, Jefferson, let me ask you, why don't we put CIRA here? Why are we putting the people who are service providers and leave the CIRA aside? Where are we going to put CIRA? Or are we going to have another paragraph for CIRA? Because the application is for me, I've applied to you. Therefore, you must remind me. Just like a TV license.
Secretary?
If you look at the problem that arose with the Central Firearms Registry with the backlogs, and we had the same provision, I think that what the Honourable Member Ndlovu was raising, we need to look at that, a period by which those applications should have been processed, whether we give them 6 months or whatever, because even if we have this clause that says if CIRA doesn't process it, your application doesn't lapse. We had a problem with the CFR where backlogs were, the renewals were just not being dealt with.
But she's just repeating what you said. So I think there's agreement. Let them go and draft something, because between what you said and what I said, there need to be an administrative justice application that comes in here that relates to CIRA. Are we in agreement on that? Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. I can just mention that the Section 26.5 that we refer to back here in subsection 4 actually relates to the administrative justice procedure, but I hear what the committee has said. We will look at the obligation on CIRA as well, Chair. Thank you, Chair. On page 49...
Sorry, I think you're correct, Commissioner Jacobs, but it address that section still does not address the obligation of CIRA to come back to the service provider to inform them your renewal has been successful, it's been finalized, or your renewal has been rejected for X, Y, Z reasons. And either we put it here or we put, extend on 26.
Thank you, Chair. On page 49, section 23, 1C, any natural person applying for registration in terms of Section 21.1 may be registered as a security service provider if the applicant is a fit and proper person to render a security service and then C reads, has complied with the relevant prescribed training requirements in respect of any particular category referred to in Section 21A.
Happy. Continue, please.
Thank you, Chair. The next amendment is on page 50. I will just also refer to the previous page just for the introduction. Any natural person applying for the registration in terms of Section 21.1 may be registered as a security service provider if the applicant is a fit and proper person to render a security service and is not currently employed in the public administration. Chair, we have changed the words public service to public administration because it's a wider concept. And then in subsection 2A, we have deleted the and after paragraph A and inserted that after paragraph B, and then we propose to insert paragraph C. Such security business furnishes information on the nature, scope and activities of the security business with reference to the categories referred to in Section 21A.
Does it make sense? Members, can I hear you? Honourable Kulavana.
I just want some clarity. I'm sure I'm missing it, but in 23C, it talks about the prescribed training requirements in Section 21A. Perhaps I have the wrong section. 21A that I'm looking at doesn't refer to training. What page would that be on, the actual training requirements?
Commissioner Jacobs.
Let's see, the categories is of course 21A, and the training can be prescribed in terms of the regulation section, as well as the training part.
The reason I'm querying this is that if it's falling under regulations, again, we had asked to see the regulations, which I haven't yet seen, maybe they're here, but I'm always wary of waiting, because it's the regulations that inevitably slow down the actual implementation of legislation. So I'm very keen to see them and to see what training there is prescribed.
Can I just say that it should, I think that section should read in section 21A3, because 3 refers to the training. That it's be more specific, so that we don't the person doesn't have to look at the whole 21A. And then the issue of the regulations is an issue that has been run through the whole process of this bill. It's clear that we do have a problem with the regulations on the Principal Act. Can I get an indication from Siraj? The regulations are here.
Yes, Chair, the regulations are here. Yesterday when I was with General Jacobs, I was made to believe that part of those regulations were sent via email to yourself, Chair.
I hope to the Secretary of the Committee and not to myself, because if it's sent to myself, it doesn't mean that it's going to reach the committee. It's been sent to the Secretary.
Chair, I send it to your address, unfortunately.
And we just make sure that we send it to the Secretary of the Committee so that they can make copies for members of it.
We have hard copies here, so we'll give it to the Secretary.
That's fine. Can we continue then?
Thank you, Chair. Page 51, section 26. It's proposed that the section reads, the authority must suspend the registration of a security service provider if there is a prima facie case of A, improper conduct in terms of this act, or B, a commission of an offence referred to in the schedule. And then, Chair, we propose to insert Roman 1, pending the conclusion of an investigation or inquiry by the authority into the alleged improper conduct, or 2, pending the conclusion of the criminal investigation by the state into the offence that that security service provider, or a determination by the prosecuting authority, or the finalization of criminal proceedings in regard to the offence. And we propose to insert, the authority may suspend the registration of a security service provider if A, the security service provider fails to comply with the obligation to pay the levy in terms of Section 4 of the Levies Act, and B, the security service provider fails to comply with any provisions of this Act. Chair, what we have done here, we have made the differentiation between the must and the may, and we have rearranged the section. Maybe what we still need to do here, and when I read through this morning, I realized that, Chair, there was also observations in the committee about this. In all instances, maybe to insert 1B, in all instances where the regulation of the security service provider is suspended, the provisions of the PIA Act must be applied to bring the administrative justice process in as well. There were observations on that. Yeah.
Can I ask you, in terms of this, I want to understand the first section correctly. The company can be suspended if there's a prima facie case. I'm worried about pending the conclusion of an investigation or inquiry by the authority, or be pending the conclusion of criminal investigation by the state. it's not like we're suspending a state official. We suspend the business license of a company. It affects the lives of thousands of people. And that's what worries me a bit. Is it not too broad? I'm just asking that because I don't have a problem when it's a prima facie case and that there's, for instance, the national prosecutor has decided to prosecute. But can we really suspend the licensing of that company while the investigation is going on?
Madam, is that different from yours? But on the, especially on that first one, what happens if now after investigation you find that there was no wrongdoing by this company? You are opening yourselves to litigations because if those people have lost money, people have lost their jobs, you are opening yourself. That's why I'm saying, how do we avoid such things? I'm not saying it's not to be done, but if it is after the investigation, and then there's going to be big loss.
I think this is really, to my mind, way too broad. It would include, let us say there is a single security officer who commits some sort of illegal act. It could be then that the business license is removed because there is a person. The license refers to the registration of the entire service provider. So does the criminality have to be against the entire company, against one individual, against one director? The other five directors are absolutely legit. So I think we may well find that this is way too broad.
Look, I'm well aware that it was us that said must, that we must differentiate between the must and the maze. I'm very well aware of that. But what I'm wondering is whether this was our intention to be that broad, and whether it shouldn't be after the must be suspended after being found guilty. Must, because that's where we want to get to, is in the court of law, this company is found guilty on a criminal activity or something on the act, and then they must be suspended automatically. It's almost like the subs members that are found guilty on criminal acts. What we want to do is not to have CIRA. We don't want CIRA to have the discretion after they were found guilty in the court of law to determine whether a company can or cannot be suspended. So that I think that is where we want to get at in terms of that was the intention, at least from the committee side. So maybe we can just have a look at it again.
Point I was mulling over is that the security service provider fails to comply with the obligation to pay the levy. Now, you know, I'm very glad there's a may there because, of course, the issue of the levies and not knowing millions and millions of rands going into CIRA and they don't know who it's from could land you in deep trouble. I don't know how someone can prove they sent the money, but if CIRA says they don't know who it came from, it may not have been them. The entire company could be a threat because of CIRA's inability to do their job.
You know, I think they were more talking about the issue, the problem on identifying is on individual security officers' payments, if I'm not mistaken, looking at CIRA. Necessarily think there's a problem in terms of that because it's saying may. There's a may in there. Honourable Ms. Logan.
I think, Chairperson, this paragraph must be very clear because when I talk about the director and employees of the company, because it can be the director that is in trouble and all others are free, and then what will happen and so on. Those are the things that we must talk about, we must think about when we are saying these things. So that when we are taking action, people mustn't suffer because of one director has done a bad thing, and then the whole company, it always involving the whole company and so on and so forth. Let's say you have a company, Chair, and we are, and where I employed, where I employed of your company, and you have a prima facie case, and you have been investigated and so on and so forth. What about us? Those are the things. I'm asking that question so that when we deal with this paragraph, we understand exactly what we're talking about.
The problem is, Honourable Ndlovu, in your argument, it is the individual that registered the company, and there are requirements around the individual. So while the individual security officer working at that company won't necessarily lose the accreditation, the company might be suspended, shut down. And that we must accept, because that's the same things within the finance financial institutions. But I agree with you that we need a bit more clarity on it. Honourable George?
I wanted to respond to my dear tweet. I was just to say, the only thing I was worried about is just make sure, but if the director, because you might not know that this director probably is going the major shares in this company, and if he has done something wrong, then the company affects even those people. But all what we are saying, make sure that you don't make people suffer and later discover that you there was no case, because then you open yourself to litigation.
Jacobs, I think you've got the drift of what we're saying is after being found guilty in court, there should not be, we can even, if you think it's necessary to specify certain things, but I mean there are disqualifying criteria, and it's basically if you're found guilty of one of those disqualifying criteria that you would then lose your license to operate. Can we continue then? We'll come back to this section.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, the next amendment is on page 60, the appointment of inspectors, subsection 5. It's page 60, Chair. It's about the appointment of persons to assist an inspector. We propose that it read, the director may appoint any person who is not in the full-time employment of the authority to assist an inspector with a particular inspection. In other words, that person would not be an inspector, but he may assist the inspector with a particular inspection.
Sorry, I'm going to get to that point, but I've got something on page 50 of the previous version, the first version, number 9, that wasn't changed either. Section 26.9. Dealt with these changes yet. It's where we sit at that point in time. I see it's affected on the changes that you give to us today, but we haven't gone through them. The authority must, through the council, report any suspension or withdrawal. Have you got it? It's on your new version. It's on page 54, 9 at the bottom. So, members, you must also help me check backwards, please, that we don't miss these things.
Now, Chair, the committee has requested us to insert in subsection 9, the committee asks to insert through the council must report any suspension or withdrawal of registration made in terms of subsection 7
and any upliftment of suspension or registration made in terms of subsection 8 to the minister within 30 days of the suspension, withdrawal or upliftment.
I'm sorry, I'm raising it because it's important that we go back to these things that we have requested that they be changed. Are we happy with that now?
Then, Chair, I'll just refer on page 55 as well, subsection 10, the authority must include any report referred to in subsection 9 in its annual report.
Members, we're happy with that because I think that's what we asked for. Happy? Okay, let's continue then. Where is it now? Page 60.
Subsection 5, the director may appoint any person who is not in the full-time employment of the authority to assist an inspector with a particular inspection. And sub B, any appointment made in terms of subsection 5A must be included in the annual report referred to in section 16A.
I'm sorry, I'm still going back because page 54 in the first version, page 55 in fact, there were proposed changes. 55 in the old version, the first version, and the 31, 32 there were changes suggested, 34, 5 and 6 there were changes suggested. Maybe you can't leave this to me alone, please. The very, very first one, because that's the one that we went through in detail. Page 55. And the two there were suggestions, they were correction in terms of brackets that need to be made. The it is, and the four, minister through regulations, four, five, the through regulations.
Chair, is it 3-5 or 5-5?
No, it's page 55. Paragraph 3, paragraph 4, actually paragraph 4 and 5. The procedure in connection with the lodging and prosecution of an appeal in terms of section must be prescribed, and we said by the Minister through regulations. Both of them, 4 and 5.
We'll just go through that, Chair, on page 58 of the
new one.
Of the new one. Page 58, it's appeal against decisions. In subsection 2, an appeal committee contemplated in subsection 1 is appointed by the minister to lead for every appeal and consists of a person with not less than 5 years experience as an attorney, advocate or magistrate who is the presiding officer and may also include two other persons if the lead it is, so it's if considered appropriate by the minister, and 2A, an appeal committee is appointed to function on a part-time basis for a period not exceeding 3 years on such terms and conditions as determined by the minister. B, a member of the appeal committee may resign by notice in writing to the minister. And then sub 4, the procedure in connection with the lodging and prosecution of an appeal in terms of this section must be prescribed by the minister through regulations. And sub 5, the amounts payable by an appellant to the authority in respect of the reproduction of records and related matters in the lodging and prosecution of an appeal must be prescribed by the minister through regulations. And then sub 8, all costs relating to the appeals procedure must be borne by the authority.
Could you point out to me where I would see I see here the structure of this, but the actual process, I presume, is going to be in the regulations. Whether or not it's determined, I mean, presumably the person who's appealing will be allowed to bring in legal representation. But I don't know, would that be determined by the regulations or determined in here?
The response is?
There are regulations pertaining to the appeals process.
Sorry that I'm taking you back, but I think it's important that we do it systematically. Chapter 5 then?
Thank you, Chair. I've read that the director may appoint any person who is not in the full-time employment of the authority to assist an inspector with a particular inspection. The next page, B, any appointment made in terms of subsection 5A must be included in the annual report referred to in section 16A.
Your members on this, are we satisfied that this is enough? I don't have a problem with what you drafting here, Commissioner Jacobs. My problem is the history of CIRA, appointing people left, right and centre at ridiculous amounts. And I'm just worried that we get ourselves in such a situation again, and I'm just wondering whether these appointments should not at least be reported to the Minister. It should be the concurrence with the Minister, because then it means the Minister must get involved in the day-to-day, but it should at least be reported. Honourable Stuber, Honourable Kulabana.
Chair, maybe it will be clearer if we can determine what type of inspection do we need a person to assist the inspector on what grounds.
Can you answer that question?
Chair, I'm not aware of any situation where we had used expertise of people outside the employment of CIRA, except when we used the police, but I take it the police is part of the AWAC to assist us.
What was the intention of this?
I think the intention when the legislation was drafted is that you may need forensic computer or audit skills when you're dealing with an investigation into a company, which your inspectors may not have. And I think that was the intention of it. CIRA may or may not have made use of that provision, but that was the intention, was that your inspectors wouldn't have forensic auditing skills or forensic computer skills, and you may need that if you seize computers during the course of your investigation.
Again, as was raised, the issue is here about payment of consultants. I think that's what we're looking at. I understand the possible need of a forensic auditor, but are fees for such consultants not determined by Treasury? Somebody, they must be laid. You can't just make it up. Surely that's predetermined somewhere. Is it or isn't it? Or am I, is that wishful thinking on my part?
What about chapters that need to say in consultation? After they've assessed the need of appointing a person and then consult the minister? What about if you say that? After they've determined the scope of whom they want to, if the director have determined the scope of a person that they want to appoint, and then thereafter
before you respond, Secretary, I understand also the need to have this, even though CIRA's not using it, and I'm not surprised that they're not using it either. But the fact of the matter is, this for me is extremely wide. We have the situation last year of a consultant being appointed. Now, this is not what you envisage here, but appointed to draft the annual report, and it was most probably the worst annual report we've ever seen. Now we might understand that same consultant is now a researcher. So this, for me, the issue is that we want the director to be able to do so, but it must be in writing. It must be reported to council, because council still remains the financial responsible entity. and it should be reported to the minister as well. And maybe if we can also craft it in such a way that it be done if there is something according to set fees or with the minister signing off on that or whatever the case may be. We don't want the minister to get involved in every one of those appointments. That's not what we aim for, because I think that's just impossible. But we do need some form of responsibility. And the first one is in writing. I think we must be explicit that it's in writing, that it be reported to the council, and that there's some sort of set fee around this issue as well. Can we get indicated?
Chair, can I also suggest that earlier this year we did a presentation together with SAPS on consultants in SAPS, and there were certain recommendations that the Portfolio Committee adopted, including quarterly reports, etc., that we go back to those recommendations that were made with regard to SAPS and that the Auditor General made with regard to consultants generally, and we include something in here to cover what the Chairperson is saying, that we agree to Council, that we include Council, but in addition to that, we look at those recommendations that the Portfolio Committee made to SAPS in this regard.
We see redraft the section, which you have now done, but it's almost like looking back at it, that the previous five was better. Because the previous five, even though it's the language might be an issue, but the previous five was saying very specifically that it's for a specific inspection. It is special expertise have meant the capacity of the authority temporarily, was not in full-time employment of the authority, for a particular inspection to assist the inspector, and then a particular inspection again. And that's why I say the language might be an issue, but I think you need to go back to some of this, and the issue of in writing and reporting. Honourable Stubbe.
Chair, just help me out there. CIRA can't arrest a person. So, if on the inspection something is wrong, they can't arrest, but they want to take a computer. Is that in the act that they can take something for, and don't they have to do that to proper policing, or are they allowed to do that, and what happened then?
It must be through a warrant that they got from court.
Can't they then put something in that after a warrant was obtained, then they can make use of a specialist to assist. Something like that.
Well, they might need a specialist before they go for a warrant, because it might be specifically the specialist information that tells them that they need a warrant afterwards. You see, I understand your concern about the warrant, but I think what we need is tightening up of this. Can we move on? Can we make the following suggestion, members, if you agree, that you re-look at it, look again at what the old five said, because it is problematic the way it's written, but it's also giving very good direction in terms of it needs to be to augment certain capacity, it needs to be for a particular inspection. So it can't be you appoint this person for the next 7 months to sit with inspectors whenever they need them. It's got to be for a specific inspection. It needs to be in writing. It needs to be according to certain criteria in terms of the funds they're for. So can you redraft that and come back to us on that issue? Are we happy with that, members? What are you saying, sir? What's the other bit saying? You please.
Thank you, Chair. Just subsection 4 on page 32. The authority must include information on any penalties imposed under subsection 3 in the annual report. That's related to the code of conduct for inspectors.
page 61, section 32.4. This request from the committee, I just want, didn't want to skip it, Chair.
Here that we suggested that it be moved to the section of the annual reports, but it's not necessary. If you're comfortable with it here, we'll leave it here.
I think it's functional to have it here.
Just on this question. Impose under subsection 3 any penalties. Doesn't have to also say how much has been collected out of those penalties. How much has been collected?
Yeah, well, that would be included in the financial statements that would be in the annual report in any case. I don't think we must be too wide on what we want. And nothing stopping the committee to ask those questions when they appear before the committee. The penalties change all the time. The penalties will be in regulations. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. I just want to refer on page 62 to section 34, 34.1A. We've inserted without prior notice. I'll read the introduction. In order to carry out an inspection of the affairs of a security service provider or another person contemplated in section 33, an inspector may at any reasonable time, A, without prior notice, subject to subsection 6, enter any premises, etc. Chair, then if we go to subsection 6, that is on page 66, you will see that an inspection of private dwellings may only be carried out when authorized by a warrant issued by a competent court. This was just to link two sections up. And then if we can just go up on the same page, page 66.3b, an inspector may use the powers in terms of this subsection only to serve the purposes of this act. We've deleted and matters incidental there too because it was regarded as being too wide, Chair.
To do 6 as well?
Yeah, Chair, I've already done that. An inspection of private dwellings may only be carried out when authorized by a warrant issued by a competent court.
Just a suggestion that where you say subject to subsection 6, I think it should be 34.6. Just to absolutely pinpoint it, thank you.
It's within the same section, Chair. Yeah.
Section 6 as it stands now defeats the A of without prior notice. You go to court. In this corrupt world that by the time you do the inspection, those people already know.
Chair, I think it will be an exception that the private dwelling will be involved. It will normally be a business premises. But I think it's not impossible that the private dwelling may be used as to perform business from. But in that event, you would need a warrant before you can do the inspection at the private dwelling.
Chair, I think that's correct. If they do it at business premises, that's in during working hours. If they need to go to a private, then they need a... I think that's correct. If you go into a private resident, you need a warrant.
It covers me, but the way it's put, it does not indicate that you're only talking about... Because inspectors in business, there are many people who inspect business. They don't have to go to court to get with the Act. That's all.
That's not what the section says. The section says that they can do their job, but when they go into a private dwelling, that they need to warrant. And I mean, obviously, when they start seizing computers and things like that, they would also need a warrant to do so. Private dwelling.
If we read 34.1, in order to carry out an inspection of the affairs of a security service provider or other person contemplated in section 30, an inspector may at any reasonable time, without prior notice, enter any premises. And that is business premises. And then we come to 6, and 6 say if you want to enter a private residence, you must have a warrant. I think that's clear.
Chair, I think just using the phrase private dwellings is not, it could be anybody's house then, anybody who they go in and they say, well, we thought you ran a company from here, or we thought you was what? I don't understand. Is the intention that they're saying that some sort of evidence is being hidden in some private home, or what? They're supposed to be inspecting private security companies and service provision. So I'm not sure, are they going into the private dwelling to see if the private security company is guarding it adequately or hiding in it or running a business from there? I'm not sure. I just would like that detailed a little more. I don't understand this provision at all.
The provision, because if you look at 3B, it's very clear that an inspector may use the powers in terms of this section only to serve the purpose of this act. So that if they do it for any other reason, they themselves are liable and will be sued. So it is, for instance, like you say, believing that somebody is hiding firearms that belongs to the security company. So I think that's they've also got a responsibility. They will report it to the police. But they've also, in the course of their job, they see or they've got reason to believe that this is happening. I'm using firearms. It can be documents. It can be anything. They can then do so only with a warrant.
Do they have the right? I mean, if they go into premises and they see a double set of books, firearms, etc., what rights do they have? Can they shut the house down, say you've all got to get out? Can they take it? Can they seize it? Surely they then have to call the SATs. By the time they get back, everything's gone. To me, it would be interference in a possible criminal matter in which the SATs should be running. So,
it is, members, I want to say again, we need to read the whole section in order to understand the section. 3A quite clearly says, inspector is appointed as a peace officer in the Republic of South Africa. So they've got certain rights when they go there. So none of what they would do would be wrong. When it gets to the criminal investigation, that criminal investigation will be conducted by SAPS. Commissioner Jacobs, you want to respond to that?
You know, I'm totally in agreement. Like, for instance, if you take at the bottom of page 65, subsection 2, any person from whose possession any item contemplated in subsection 1 has been removed or who otherwise, to the satisfaction of the director or an inspector, proves a right of ownership or possession in respect thereof may, during normal office hours, be permitted by the director or inspector to investigate, examine the item in question, or extract from any such record or document under circumstances necessary to protect the integrity of the item in question. In other words, the rules are set out very clearly, and in subsection 3 as well. An inspector, in respect of any provision of this or any other law applicable to the security service providers, is deemed to have been appointed as a peace officer by the Minister of Justice in terms of section 334 of the Criminal Procedure Act. So it's exactly those powers that the inspector will have and may exercise.
Commissioner Jacobs, I think members just need to read this whole section. There's nothing stopping us when we come back again, but I would suggest that members read 34, the whole section, in order to understand, because it's quite clear there what they may and may not do, what they may inspect and may not inspect, what they can look for, etc. It's very specific. I do, however, have a bit of a concern that they can remove something without a warrant. I do have a concern on that. And I'm asking that you maybe just have a look at whether it's not necessary for them to at least have a warrant in order to remove something from the premises of a security company. If it's not necessary, it's fine. But let's rather just get an opinion from yourselves on that issue so that we make sure about that.
Thank you, Chair. On page 67, the section 35 dealing with regulations, 35.1, the Minister may make regulations relating to any matter which A, and Chair, I must firstly say here that we have divided into the must and may. We have first inserted the may part. The Minister may make regulations relating to any matter which A, in terms of this Act, is required or permitted to be prescribed, and B, generally, is necessary or expedient to prescribe for the attainment or better attainment of the objects of this Act or performance of the functions of the authority. Chair, when it comes to the other powers, we really had difficulty to say they can be made. So we thought most of them must be a must. 1A, then, the Minister must make regulations relating to A, the requirements in respect of the infrastructure and capacity necessary for a security, we will correct that title of security, for a security business to render a security service. That's a new insertion. It's something that we missed in the powers of the regulations previously. Then B, the registration by the authority of security service providers, including the procedures in relation to the suspension, withdrawal, and lapsing of registration. C, the procedures in respect of renewal of registration and the conditions upon which such applications are to be granted. D, the obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. E, ensuring the quality of training as contemplated in Section 4K or any other law in respect of security service providers and prospective security service providers. A new insertion, EA, guidelines in respect of insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on a uniform vehicle or otherwise. If the registration and identification certificates of security service providers. G, the types of uniforms, insignia, emblem, title, symbol, distinctive badges or buttons which may not be supplied to, used or worn by a security service provider. And Chair, the next few, there are no new amendments. And then when we come to LA on page 69, the types of information which security service providers must furnish to the authority when rendering a security service outside the Republic. Chair, then on page 70, the insertion of a new paragraph SA, minimum standards applicable to security service providers responsible for the safe transportation of cash or goods with a high value, including precious metals or jewelry. Is SB, minimum standards for the provision of security services at national key points, as referred to in Section 1 of the National Key Points Act, 1980, Act No. 102 of 1980. And then in T, to delete from the end of T, the semicolon there to the end of U, generally any matter which is necessary or expedient to prescribe for the attainment or better attainment of the objects of this Act or the performance of the functions of the authority. That part was shifted to the beginning where it's a may part, so it is superfluous in this place. Then sub 2, different regulations may be made in terms of subsection 1 or LA with reference to different categories or classes of security service providers.
three regulations made in terms of subsection 1 or 1 or LA may, in respect of any contravention thereof or failure to comply therewith, prescribed as a penalty a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years. Four, the minister must, after consultation with the council, issue guidelines or policies in relation to the governance of the authority. And five, any regulation made under this section must be tabled in Parliament for, we have changed that notification to consideration, Chair.
Can I hear you on this section?
Should there not be, when you look at 1A4, instead of 1 or an L, on page 70, should that not have a time frame by which guidelines or policies are issued? That's just open-ended.
Can I hear you on it?
And ditto with the regulations, time frame.
I mean, Secretary.
Chair, I think one need to go through this again. I'll do so, but just come back to 35.1AD. The obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. Now, a service provider, where must they give... They provide training. Now, if they must undergo security training, where must they do that? Can I just hear that? That one, I'll come back to the others, please.
George, you have your hand up as well.
Madam Chair, I'm happy with the 68 EA. Insignia, emblem, title, and all that. But I've got a question. I've observed something, Madam Chair. Now, this gentleman next to you now is taking your attention.
Can you repeat that?
I'm saying I'm happy with that EA, but there's something that always worried me with these security companies, some of them. You go to a hospital, they put a security guard. You look at the guards there, they look so, I don't want to use it, but if you find that they are not looking well presentable. I mean, I'm not sure how we can regulate, because sometimes it also gives respect to a security company. He's got his uniform, his insignia, everything, emblems. But if he's happy, he's wearing an overcoat, which seems like it was washed 4 months ago. But I'm saying, I don't know how we can regulate that, but it would be good if security people, especially in these important places like hospitals, and that they look like people who are ready. But I'm just reading, I don't know whether we can
regulate. I'll ask Mr. Tully whether they've got a job for you as an inspector there, because that's exactly what these guys should be doing, because the part of the legislation is actually to make sure that the companies issue their people with enough uniforms, etc. So that's part of the legislation. So Mr. George's point is not ridiculous. It's actually correct. But it's part of what the Act already makes provision for, to make sure that security companies provide their people with the necessary uniform, with the necessary shoes, and not subtract it from their salaries, because that's what they're doing. Many of these unscrupulous companies is what they're doing. They subtract it from the salary, the mediocre salary that the guard is getting in any case. And those are the things that they must regulate and they must inspect. So what you were raising, Mr. George, is just another indication of the problems we have at this point in time. Honourable Stube, have you had your hand up? Because your microphone is on, I see. And then Honourable Kulabana, please.
Thank you, Chair. If we look at the introduction is the minister must make regulation relating to. And then we go to EA. 1 AEA. Page 68. Guidelines in respect of insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether or on a uniform or vehicle or otherwise. And then in G we say the type of uniform, insignia, emblem, title, symbol. Isn't that stating the obvious for a second time? We said we must keep the guidelines. Now we say insignia, uniform, emblems is in there. Now we must do it again. We say it again under G. Give me some guidance there.
I understand it. The one is what is the minimum requirements. The other one is what is excluded. G is what they cannot. In other words, they can't wear a uniform with a star that looks like the police's. That's the 2-year. I don't know which necessary to have both. I think it is, but they can have a look at it and just come back to us on it. Honourable Kulabonat.
I really don't think we can lose sight of the fact that it is private security. If an entity, such as a hospital or whoever, it sees that the people guarding the entrances don't look up to scratch, they just as easy to fire them. Fire the company and start again. But they can speak to the company, and if they don't pull up their socks and they're obviously not giving their staff what they need, they're at liberty to do that. Not everything has to actually be controlled by government, and not everything is. So if I have a problem with a private security guard, I will speak to the company, as has been raised in this meeting before. You speak to the company, you try and deal with it. That's not an issue that's where you start. So really, I want to warn against trying to micromanage the business.
I don't know why you raised this issue, Honourable Kulabana, because we're not legislating for that. The fact of the matter is, if you look at the history of this Act, it was also because there was exploitation within private security companies of specifically the guards. And there still is. I mean, I've raised the issue of SAPS themselves at Bishop Labour's College, where the security service providers don't, the security officers there don't have uniforms to wear. So it is part of what they inspect. But you're quite correct that the company that hires them will take it up with them. But we're not legislating for that, so we don't have to. You don't have to entertain Mr. George's point that he raised here. Can I get a response on these issues that were raised from the technical team, and then I want to move on, please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 69, the Honourable Colonel Barnett referred to LA, the types of information, and proposed that we insert their time periods or time frames. We can do that, Chair, to broaden the scope of the regulation. Then there was a question on paragraph D, the obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. I think, Chair, maybe the authority can assist there, but I can mention, for example, firearms training. There are accredited training service providers which provide the firearms training, and in terms of the regulations, there's a lot of prescripts relating to the obligatory training, etc., that must be undergone.
Can we just look at the 351A D, page 67. The obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. Can you explain that? Because there keep some questions coming around that.
I understand it that it's the undergoing of security training by security service providers. In other words, as security service providers, say for instance like firearms training that they need to get, and there are accredited trainers who provide that training. And then there are also some societal determinations on levels of training for specific types of security guards that need level A or B training. So this provision allows the minister to provide those levels of training, etc., that must be undergone by security service providers.
Honourable Stephen, Honourable...
Yeah, I understand that part, but this thing said the obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. Does that mean that a company that registers as a security company, that they, what I understood now is their personnel must undergo the training? But the other... On the other side, also the obligation under of security training by security service providers. I think we must say, because I read it as that the security service providers must also undergo security training. That's how I see it here. How I read it, and somebody out there may also interpret it the way I interpret it. Can we just get clearance on that?
Regulated, yeah. I want to understand it correctly. Indeed, and I don't know whether the problem is not the obligatory undergoing of security training by security service providers. Maybe what we need is for a specific type of security service or whatever the case may be, because it, as it is now, it seems like it's wide. I think that's the one. But there we're talking about the individual. Let me just finish. And then the other one that you have referred to is CIRA also have a responsibility to regulate those companies that do business in providing security training.
That's the word provider.
That's ensure the quality of training as contemplated in Section 4K or any other law in respect of security service providers and Facebook security service providers. You see, there is a training missing there somewhere. You need to look at those two. I think we know what you are saying, but I don't think it's clear. Can we just relook those and then come back to them on that? Honourable Legetu?
Yes, same D, the talking of obligatory training is detailed elsewhere than here. If that's my question.
It will be detailed in the regulations. That is what it's saying here. It will be detailed in the regulations. Members, while before we carry on, can I just welcome the Honourable Sifa Morocco sitting there. He is Morocco. He is a new member of the committee for the ANC. You're more than welcome. We're looking forward to your input. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to point out that the committee did mention the issue about the use of lights. We again looked at the regulations under the National Road Transport Act, Chair, and it's clear that the regulations presently says a vehicle...
Can I ask members to concentrate on what Commissioner Jacobs is saying? When I said a new member, I didn't mean the member was new. He's new to this committee. And logic prescribed, you all saw him here for the past few years, so I presume you would know that he's not new to Parliament. Can we please concentrate on what's happening?
Chair, the provision in terms of the National Road Transport Act in the regulations is that a vehicle owned by a body or person registered as a security officer in terms of the Security Officers Act 1987, and unfortunately the reference there is still to the old act, but in terms of interpretation, the new act's provisions must be read in here, be driven by a security officer as defined in Section 1 of the said act in the course of rendering a security service, also defined in the Section 1 of the said Act, may be fitted with a white lens bar containing a lamp or lamps emitting an intermittently flashing diffused white light in any direction, and containing a notice illuminated by a white light containing the word security and the name of the owner of the vehicle in black letters, provided that the said lamp or lamps shall not be capable of emitting a rotating or strobe light. Chair, I think it would be wrong to make any other provision relating to the use of lights.
These regulations set out exactly, even if you look at a breakdown vehicle, it said that provided that such lamp shall only be used at the place where the breakdown occurred, where the maintenance or work or inspection is being carried out, when such breakdown vehicle is towing a motor vehicle or in the event of a vehicle carrying an abnormal load. So there's really extensive provisions. I think if one look at the security service providers in general in the street, you see that I think many of them do comply with these things. I think it's once again a compliance matter, that in terms of the use of lights which are not allowed, that there really must be enforcement of this act. And I think, Chair, what I can suggest is that maybe the committee could suggest to the Department of Transport to consider aligning these regulations with the present act and not the old one, although in terms of the Interpretation Act, one would read that in here. But I think the old act is already from 1987, and I don't think there's anything wrong with updating regulations to present requirements, Chair.
So what you're basically saying to us is not necessary for us to regulate for this. It's already regulated for. Okay. Thanks. And we're satisfied with that. But what we want to see also is that CIRA implement this part of it and regulate this part of it, because they're not doing that. Can we continue then?
No, I think in terms of enforcement, if you see a vehicle and it doesn't comply with this, it is an offence in terms of the National Road Traffic Act, and even if you just lay a complaint, the road traffic people will have to follow it up. Thank you, Chair.
What is it now?
It's not necessary for us to include anything on the lights because it's already... We're coming back to that. I've asked him to clarify this whole issue and come back to us. Can we continue?
Thank you, Chair. Page 71, provision of information to authority. We propose to delete the words to authority. 36.3. The authority must inform the registrar as defined in Section 1 of the Firearms Control Act 2000, Act No. 60 of 2000, at the time of any new registration, suspension, sale, transfer, liquidation, merger, lapsing, or termination of the registration or ownership of a security service provider, or any other material change or reason that would necessitate the licensing, relicensing, or disposal of firearms in the possession of such security service provider. So I think it was pointed out at the previous meeting that this is just to really assist the police in terms of policing and enforcement. Sub 4, the registrar mentioned in subsection 3 must, at the written request of the director, submit a list of all firearms registered to a particular service provider, security service provider, to the authority within 30 days of the request being made. Once again, Chair, this is to assist the authority and the inspectors of the authority when they do inspections to check the firearms registered to a company in respect of what is in stock at the moment. Then 5, the authority must report to Parliament in respect of information provided by the authority to the registrar in terms of subsection 3. And I think the committee commented that this is really a sort of a cross checking and referencing to see whether that information has been followed up.
Are we happy with that? I think so. Can we then take a break now? Tea is ready. It's 11. It's 11:05. Can we be back here? Let's take a 15-minute break. 20 past, please.
Gracias.
Thank you.
Anything, any sitting, any... No, that's it. And next week,
Is anything happening next week? Where would I find the email? Could you send me the email
number?
Yeah. We've changed. You're on, no longer 3741 and... Why is he anyway? But so I can ask him in Bengal. Thank you very much. Morning, sir. You're from Tap, sir?
Oh, yeah, this is not the one.
Thank you very much. Wonderful, sir.
Thank you.
of PNG, the Parliamentary Monitoring Group, yeah.
At the bottom of page 71, security services rendered outside the Republic. Chair, I think we have dealt with it, but I will just touch on it. 36A1, any person who within the Republic recruits, trains, hires out, sends or deploys any other person to provide the security service outside the Republic must A, provide to the director on a quarterly basis such information as may be prescribed regarding such recruitment, training, hiring out, sending or deployment or nature of the security service within the prescribed time limits, and B, comply with the provisions of this Act. Two, a person referred to in subsection 1 may not engage in any activity or render any assistance that is prohibited in terms of the prohibition of mercenary activities and regulation of certain activities in country of armed conflict Act, or the regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act 1998. Three, any person who A, is employed by another person from outside the Republic, and B, is deployed from the Republic to perform armed guarding services outside the Republic, must at least 2 weeks before the deployment inform the authority of such deployment in the prescribed manner. For the information referred to in subsection 3 must be submitted by the authority to the State Security Agency, and that is an amendment that the committee requested, within 7 days of receipt of the notification. Chair, the committee also asked that we must look at these pieces of legislation. I just want to bring to the attention of the committee that the 2006 Act, 27 of 2006, has never been put into operation yet. So that act is still, and there were even requests from the United Nations, one of the committees looking at Somalia, etc., which requested the government to indicate why this act is not yet into operation. But Chair, presently the Regulation of Foreign Military Assistance Act is in force. The advantage of the 2006 Act is that it really defines security services, which is not defined in the older Act, Foreign Military Assistance Act. So the new Act was really intended to fill all the gaps in terms of combating mercenary activities, and it is being administered by the Department of Defense. So Chair, I think it will also assist in combating the type of issues that we're looking in terms of this Act, if that Act can come into operation soon. I don't know what the reasons are for the non-implementation of the Act. Chair, but I think those are the issues. I have copies of the legislation available if someone wants to look at it, but I don't think the committee requested a sort of a briefing on the legislation, but we have it available, Chair.
Members, can I hear you on this section?
Yes. You know, some of these security companies, who are some of them 100% foreign-owned, they also got their staff members who are not South Africans. what we say about them must stay again. Even if they deploy that person to another, it's not a South Africa. Does that also need the authority from CIRA?
You can respond to it, but I would think if the person is operating from South Africa, the same rules should apply. But you can respond to it.
Chair, the situation we looked at is specifically one of the issues is the provision of security services relating to anti-piracy operations. And here it's almost like a circle. People come to South Africa, they board the ship here because the danger actually starts from north of our borders to the Middle East. So they then accompany the ship, and then on arrival there they would come back by airplane again to South Africa. So the intention is really to address any person who is being deployed from South Africa. So it doesn't matter whether that person might be working for G4 Security in Britain or in any other country. Once he's being deployed from South Africa, he needs to give this information through. Because the other problem is that there's also firearms by the tick available. And that is one of the areas where we've also looked at a system where the permits are being issued to the right people, because we had instances in Durban, for example, that the permit is issued to a company which sells firearms. And that person would hand over these firearms to the security officer, and there's no, if I can say, chain of possession in terms of the regulation, the permits. So that's something we've already addressed to some extent. But the idea is really to address every person that's been deployed from South Africa to get a database of those people. And if you would look at the profile of these people, they are highly trained. Most of them are ex-special services, the Spetsnaz, Special Air Service in the UK, US Special Services. It's a person who is involved in private security, but the profile could just as well be that of a mercenary. So, but I think, Chair, the mercenary problem has to a large extent been addressed to quite a degree, in the sense that a lot of these people are now involved in if I can say, formal and legal security that's being provided on ships for anti-piracy operations.
Honourable George?
Chairperson, if you read 36A1, does it refer to the entity or to a person with section 2 of that section? Does it refer to the entity or a person?
Honourable George?
Madam Chair, there was a law which was passed by defense. And I hear now, he says that it has not been implemented. Because it also had to cover some of these things. Now, can I know from him as a general, but as an advocate, why is that law not implemented?
He indicates that he doesn't know what the reasons are. That is not for him to say. The president has not enacted it yet. That's the bottom line. So we can, as a committee, inquire why it's not been enacted and encourage our defense to follow up on it. But he's in no position to respond to that question. Honourable Lekhetu?
Thanks, Chair. I agree with Honourable George. But you were saying, Advocate, that you have the copies of that Act. I'll be happy to read that Act myself. And probably to be workshopped, if possible, on the matter. Thanks, Chair.
If you have got an interest in it, you can read the Act, and you're welcome to get further clarity on that Act, but I think we've got enough work as it is. Honourable Stewart?
Chair, just to get back to 3, any person who is employed by another person from outside the Republic, and B, is deployed from the Republic to perform armed guarding service outside the Republic, must at least 2 weeks before the deployment inform the authority of such a deployment in the prescribed manner. And still my concern, this is an individual that must raise it. It is not, the onus is not on the company that make use of his services. It's on the individual. And being out there, and we can't say ignorance of the law is no excuse, but how are we going to make this, how are we going to let know the people out there that this is what you should comply with? I think it is, I don't think we can regulate it. I think it's very, very difficult to regulate. If somebody can just tell me what can we do, or is it more easier than I foresee?
I will respond to both your question and Honourable Lawless's question now, but can I also just say in 1A, we did say that the may must be a must. Provide to the director on a quarterly basis such information as must be prescribed. Otherwise, what are they going to prescribe? It must be a must. Not a may. Can we continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. 36A1 refers to any person. And in this regard, Chair, you will recall that the definition of person includes a natural person as well as a... as well as an entity, a company, yeah, company or a natural person. Then, Chair, if we come to sub 3, any person is employed by another person, the question from Mr. Stubber. Chairperson, as I've said, there are issues, especially when it comes to maritime security and anti-piracy, where firearms is also required, and when permits are being applied for. So one will to some extent, and even with those permits, there's some, I don't want to say a CV, but there's some background given about the person to whom the firearms license will be, not license, permit will actually be given. So there is to some extent, there is activity that can be cross-checked in terms of if you receive an application for firearms but the person hasn't informed CIRA, that will also give you some grounds to look very negatively towards the firearms compliance. So, Chair, there are some ways. I agree it is something that's not regulated presently, but we need to find ways. And I think especially with the reporting to the State Security Agency and cooperation between the State Security Agency and SAPS, there are things that can be done to enforce this type of issue. But I think, Chair, we need a legal obligation for a reporting. Once a person does not report, and there are many ways to find this out, it's basically at the moment one port in Durban that's being used for this, by checking the port and who's going in, out, and on ships and that type of thing. There are ways in which you can determine who is involved in this type of security. To really catch on to people who are busy with pure mercenary activities, that might be more difficult, but I also don't want to say it's impossible, Chair.
Honourable Mulabachi, Honourable George, in that order, please.
Chair, I do agree that if it concerns the maritime issue, it's fine. You can regulate that. Where there's a firearm involved, you can't take a firearm out of the country, and there's regulations to that. But for instance, and this is my problem. If I'm I finished my studies and I get an invitation to come and work in Sudan or Iraq or wherever, and it involves security, I'm going there and all of a sudden they put a gun in my hand, before I go I must report it. How are we going to regulate those people? To me there's two categories. There's the person that go outside and the other day was somebody's on a working holiday in London. And all of a sudden they get in contact with a security company and they say, come and work for us, here's more money for you, and you happen to land up in another place. How are you going to to comply to this. The one is easy. The one with the maritime, it's clear to me. But this one is to me, I foresee a problem.
Thank you, Chair. The explanation that General Jacobs gave, will it include the checking of criminal records?
Madam Chair, you know, during that war in Iraq, we lost a lot of our special forces from the police and defense, primarily because that's why we had to make that act. But I see a problem here, at least 2 weeks to inform. 2 weeks is too late for somebody who's going to go outside the country. It means by that time, the whole thing has been done. And it also says inform. And it means probably, I don't know how process takes for information, by the time the CIRA meets and look at the thing, the person is gone already. And I'm saying probably 2 weeks, I'm not sure 2 weeks is reasonable.
Secretary and Commissioner Jacobs, can you respond to the issues that you raised?
Can I just be clear? CIRA is not regulating those people. CIRA is purely informing state security of those people. And I hear what the Honourable Member Sleeve is saying about maritime, but it isn't only maritime where we have this problem. It's basically where people are being recruited. And we may have to go on some drive that where people are informed that if they do this. And I also hear what Honourable Member Sleeve is saying, that somebody's on holiday somewhere. But the intentions of this is that South Africans are being recruited to go and provide security services outside the country. And sometimes those security services are actually verging on mercenary activities. And the idea is for state security to be aware, because often state security will hear about those things post-facto. So CIRA is not actually regulated. So there wouldn't be criminal record checks or whatever. They would need to notify state security, and state security would then check and see if there is a problem here. But CIRA is not actually regulating that activity. And I do, as I say, I hear what Honourable Member Sleeve is saying. But the problem is not just in maritime. It's in people being recruited, and then you read in the UN report that South Africans were recruited and they're involved in this country, in this activity, and we need to look at that. And if that means that we need to go on some drive to inform people that if they're being recruited, they have a reporting obligation, then we need to do that.
Just give Commissioner Jacobs an opportunity to respond as well, then I'll come back to you.
Thank you, Chair. And I think what we should take into account, Chair, is that the actual mercenary activities are actually being addressed through that other piece of legislation. What we are doing here is an over and above reporting obligation, which we were asked to insert in our legislation when that mercenary legislation was debated in the Defence Committee. Chair, that mercenary legislation was debated after the Equatorial Guinea event. And if I can mention, for example, the people on that plane, the plane was stopped in Zimbabwe, and there were indications they are on their way for to perform this coup. Now, suppose that the plane was stopped in South Africa, and the cover they had was that they were going to provide security services in the DRC. Now, if you would stop that plane in South Africa and there's no other evidence on board like maps, etc., that you can use to say they were on their way to Equatorial Guinea and not the DRC, you can actually say these people were on their way to perform a security service in the DRC then, but there's no indication they haven't given the information through to CIRA, etc., etc. So it really, I think at least it tightens the control over this type of activity.
It's at least 2 weeks. I think that is where we need to read it, Honourable George. It says at least, they can do it as soon as they start the process. It's up to the individual, but it can't be 2 weeks later than 2 weeks before they leave the country.
But it's somebody, because some of these people have got some misinformation, they have got some wrong doings in their mind. Surely they'll exploit that, will submit it in 2 weeks, knowing fully well that before they even look at this thing, will be gone.
I think we must remember what Commissioner Jacobs is also saying, that this is not to regulate, it is to have further information and assistance to state security around these deployments. So it's not for CIRA to make a decision on it, not at all. CIRA's got to make no decision on it. It's got to, they've got to inform state security about it. Honourable Stubbe? Look, I think that, Honourable Stubbe, I would urge that you have a look at the two acts that, because that will give you some clarity. I think some of us have the advantage that we were part of drafting those two acts, so we a bit more play on the reasoning behind it at that point in time. I remember clearly it was an ad hoc committee that dealt with those issues, and it consisted out of defense, state security, and police when we drafted that legislation. So some of us who's been here during that time have a bit more understanding of this issue. Can I continue, Honourable Thiel?
Chairperson, thank you. It's just to understand, South Africans can be recruited to go and do security work outside the country. And the people, outside people, outside from foreigners, are they also recruited to come and do security work inside the country? And if not, or if yes, why so? Because it's so difficult for our people here in the country to get security companies or to get tenders as securities. Thank you, sir. Thank
you. Well, you can respond to that, but the bill is not addressing ownership at this stage. The bill already, the act already makes provision for non-South Africans not being able to do certain kinds of security. But you can respond to that question if you want to.
Thank you, Chair. Now, I think, Chair, firstly, let's take maritime security, for example. A UK ship will sail from the UK to the Middle East via Africa, so or Southern Africa. So when that ship leaves there, they get the services of a security company that's registered, for instance, in the UK. So all that person will do, he will fly from the UK and he will come to Durban. When the ship passes Durban, he will get aboard on board of the ship. Because there's no real, except for West Africa, some parts around Nigeria, the real pirate threat is around the coast of Somalia. So that person will get on the ship here, and so he will actually not perform any service in South Africa. He's performing a service to the shipping company on that ship. But what we are concerned with is that the person is leaving our country. He's coming to South Africa. He's leaving our country. He's providing a security service, whether it's on the ship or what, but it's outside our country. But our country is used as a base. And that is one of the concerns we need to address. But once again, I don't think this even relates to the foreign ownership, etc., because it's a service that's being delivered to an outside company, merchant shipping, not to South Africans, and South Africans are not involved. It's not to say that South Africans can also not be involved, but this will apply to both. If a South African will do security services on a ship, you also need to inform. But a person is recruited from outside South Africa to perform security services, the full might of the law is applicable to that person. You need to be registered, everything, and you will recall, Chair, that there's actually a prohibition, if I can put it that way, on foreigners to be involved in private security. If a security officer wants to be involved, exemption from the minister is actually required. And you will recall that's the only type of service where exemption can be granted is for the security officer himself. Because what we have written into the bill now is that on the board and as the director will not be allowed to be a foreigner. Thank you, Chair.
Can we then continue, please? Are we satisfied? Continue. Make a note of the May that must become a must as well.
Thank you, Chair. On page 74, paragraph D, that the committee asked that we must stiffen the issue about the use of insignia, etc. That is now with the any security service provider who, one, allows the use of any insignia, emblem, title or symbol, whether on uniform or vehicle or otherwise, or two, allows the use of any uniform which corresponds or can be confused with any uniform, insignia, emblem, title or symbol used by the South African National Defence Force or the South African Police Service, is guilty of an offence and liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment. Chair, although there are similar provisions in the South African Police Service Act and the Defence Act, we thought it wise that it should also be reflected in this Act, also linked up with the power of the authority who can refuse to allow the use of certain uniforms, etc. And what is a crux to this is really whether it can be confused or whether it corresponds to SANDF and South African Police Service uniform.
Police will be covered by this as well or not?
Chair, I was thinking about this, and maybe we must insert the Metro Police, because they actually, in terms of regulation, there is a responsibility of our minister in respect of Metro Police as well.
On 38B, did you say after inspector or any other?
In fact, I also was that. On 38B, we said that interferes with, resists, obstructs, hinders or delays an inspector or any other person lawfully accompanying an inspector. Because it was just for easier reading. Or any other. 38B, bottom of page 73. It's just something I think that you missed. We said after an inspector, comma, or any other person. And then we agree, members, with the inclusion of Metro Police. Are you happy with that? Can we then continue, please?
Thank you, Chair. On page 75, paragraph I, commits an act which is calculated to hinder, impede or obstruct any investigation in terms of this Act or the Levies Act, is guilty of an offence and, one, in the case of a natural person, on a first conviction of a contravention referred to in paragraph A, E, F, G and H, is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment, and in the case of a juristic person, to a fine. Two, in the case of a natural person, on a second or subsequent conviction of a contravention referred to in paragraph A, E, F, G and H, is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years, or to both the fine and such imprisonment, and in the case of a juristic person, to a fine. And then three, in the case of a natural person on a conviction of a contravention referred to in paragraph B, C, D or I, and you will see, Chair, that we've deleted E, F, G and H, which we have shifted up to ensure a stiffer penalty for that, is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 24 months, or to both a fine and such imprisonment, and in the case of a juristic person, to a fine. We have aligned this also to the construction we used in the DNA legislation, Chair.
That is something that we've asked for, that we just make sure that we cover the lesser and the more severe penalties. Are you happy with that? Continue then, please.
On page 76, Chair, the insertion, paragraph 3A, any person who fails to comply with the provisions of section 36A1 or 3 is guilty of an offence and is liable A, in the case of a natural person on a first conviction, to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 10 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment, and in the case of a juristic person, to a fine, or B, in the case of a natural person on a second or subsequent conviction, to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years, or to both a fine and such imprisonment, and in the case of a juristic person, to a fine.
Honourable Stewart?
Chair, is the fine for 10 years a maximum of not exceeding 10 years? Isn't that too stiff a penalty? Are we realistic with that?
It says exceeding, not exceeding 10 years, and I think we must look at that. So the court still have the court will still decide. We're not deciding. The court will still make the final decision. Can I hear you on that, Commissioner Jacobs?
Yes, sir. I think it is a rather stiff fine, even for a first offence, and this relates to that reporting of security officers that will do services outside the Republic. But I think, Chair, it's about the message that's being sent out as well. One could look at the offence and maybe see whether you should not make it, say, 5 years and 10 years. But I really think there was some message in it as well in terms of the seriousness of the penalty that can be given.
Can I ask you also just refer back to the two acts that we have spoken about and just see whether it is in line with those? Then you can come back to us on that.
Jefferson, it can be any years, not exceeding 10 years. It can be 2 years. It can be 5 years.
That's why I say it's not a big issue. Let them go and have a look. If they feel that there is a contradiction, they can come back to us. But I don't think it's a problem either, because, as I say, the court can still decide.
Thanks, Chair. The next is page 76, the extraterritorial application of the Act and Jurisdiction. Chair, we have seriously looked at this section once again. You'll recall that I've made an observation at the previous meeting that we cannot really see the purpose of this because we normally, if there's extraterritorial jurisdiction, the Act says which offence can be committed outside the Republic, which will also be an offence in South Africa. In this regard, Chair, if a person performs security services in Botswana and Botswana doesn't have any security legislation, service legislation requiring registration, etc., we cannot prosecute a person for that in South Africa. So we really thought that there might have been some reason for inserting this, but what we have done as well is to strengthen the issues about people performing services from South Africa in other countries and the reporting obligation. So, Chair, at this stage, the recommendation is that we actually delete Section 39.
You have spoken to the state law advisors on it, because you had a note there at the bottom to say speak to the state law advisors, and they've satisfied with the state law advisors. You're happy with the removal thereof?
Yes, we are.
Members, are we in agreement?
Yes.
Okay, then let's remove Section 39.
Thank you, Chair. Then on page 77, Chair, the committee has already made a decision at the previous meeting on the delegation of powers by the Minister. That is the delegation of powers to the National Commissioner, and whereas the National Commissioner is not in any event involved in the administration of this Act. So the proposal is also to delete that from the Act, that's Section 41. Thank you, Chair. Then on page 83, Chair, we have inserted a number of other offences in the schedule. The first one that we've already indicated to the committee is an offence in terms of the Regulation of Interception of Communications and Provision of Communication-Related Information Act, and any offence in terms of the Intelligence Services Act. Then, Chair, the committee asked us to look at other offences as well. We've also included now any offence of trafficking in persons as defined in Section 1 of the Prevention and Combating of Trafficking in Persons Act, and any offence of torture as defined in the Prevention and Combating of Torture of Persons Act, and any offence referred to in Part 1 or 2 of the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act, Chair.
I think to some extent the inclusion of the combating and trafficking of persons, it also addressed the example that the Honourable Stuber has made. If somebody is recruited outside to go and work outside, suddenly he's put a firearm in his hand, that would be under false pretense, etc., etc. So that would also cover that part of it. Members, can I hear you on those? Are there anything that we believe is outstanding on these that should be included? Those who serve on defence, if there's anything that you feel we must include, state security, if you feel there's anything that we must include there still? Nothing. Honourable Commissioner Jacobs.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to mention that we haven't skipped it, but regarding the transitional provisions, we discussed the transitional provisions in Section 44, Chair, and I think we are quite convinced to recommend to the committee that we should not tamper with the transitional provisions from the old Security Officers Board Act to the present Act, but that we should insert a new transitional provision relating to the amendment bill that we are busy with and the present CEDA Act. Chair, we have drafted a rough form of the transitional provisions, which we will today further elaborate on, and I think we will be able to submit that tomorrow to the committee, Chair.
I've missed that total conversation. You repeat this.
Chair, just to say that we are busy preparing transitional provisions which can be added to the existing ones as a separate subsection 44A, and we will during the course of the day we will finalise that for submission to the committee.
Also giving attention to the fact that we've set those transitional arrangements that are in the Principal Act that should that have lapsed already should be taken out.
Chair, we discussed that, and our advice to the committee is that we should rather leave them in. Even if you look at the NPA Act and so on, there are transitional provisions relating to legislation that was adopted long ago, even like the DPCI legislation, etc. That's been kept in the Act for record purposes, Chair.
Can we just go back to page 79? It's not 79, table of offences, the schedule of... Yeah, page 82 at the top. There should be trafficking persons at 7 of 2013. 7 of 2013. Can you just check that, please? And then at the bottom as well, any offence in terms of the explosive acts, there's a new one, number 15 of 2003.
We are also in trouble. That one is not enforced yet, Chair.
You make us sit here for harder, and then you don't...
No, it's not our doing. It's not our doing. But can you check the top one as well, the sexual offences, that we just get the right dates and things there, please? Okay, so we still need to keep the acts, the old acts and the Explosives Act. Why is it not...
Chair, I can just say that the regulations under that was published... The regulations were published twice for public comments, and it's quite bulky. It's more than 400 pages, just the English version. But from the legal point of view, I think for more than 2-3 years we have been ready. It's a matter of being able to implement the Act on the functional terrain that's bothering us. From the legal side, we are in a position with everything.
We go through processes of saying implementation plan when we do legislation. Then the department comes here and they tell you we can implement, and they give you all these glamorous and big whoas about how they're going to implement, and only to hear hula-baloo as you wish, only to hear 10 years later that it's not that. Okay, and then can I just ask that you look at the DNA schedule that refers to Explosives Act as well. There's a definite referral to that schedule, that we just look at that one as well, that it be included there. Thank you. That is for now. For this part, we're starting afresh now.
That's right, from scratch, yeah.
Starting from page one again, then this on the new bill. Now, just to check that we've got everything that we've said previously, this should go quickly, it shouldn't be too long. You can continue, please.
Thanks, Chair. I think we made the observation that on page 2, the long title that we will align that with the final provisions, Chair. On page 4, there's an insertion, 12A, Secretariat, and 14A, disqualifications for appointment as Director and Deputy Directors, 15 to be deleted, 16 to be changed from Funds of Authority to Finances of Authority, 16A, Annual Report, insertion, 17, 18 and 19 to be deleted. Then in Chapter 3, the insertion of 20A, Exemption Advisory Committee, the insertion of 21A, Categories of Security Businesses. Then on page 5, the insertion of 36A, Security Services Rendered Outside the Republic. The deletion on page 6 of 39, Extraterritorial Application of Act and Jurisdiction. And the deletion of 41, Delegation of Powers by Minister.
Are we happy, members? Okay, continue, please.
Chair, I will go through all the amendments, not just the marked ones, if there might be something, but I won't dwell too long on the issues. The Civilian Secretariat definition, Chair, we have already discussed previously, and we haven't made any new amendments to that. Company was just the deletion of the previous reference to 2008 Act No. 71 of 2008. The Levies Act means the Private Security Industry Levies Act 2002, Act No. 23 of 2002. The definition of locksmith, Chair, we have inserted locksmith means a person including an apprentice employed by a locksmith who for the benefit of another person engages in any activity or business which is related to A, designing and managing master key systems, B, installing, maintaining, repairing and changing the combinations of safes, vaults and safety deposit boxes, C, maintaining key code records, D, cutting keys and duplicating existing keys, or E, opening, closing or engaging of locking mechanisms of any nature by means of a specialized device in any manner. And minister means the minister, the member of the cabinet responsible for policing. I just think that bracket in front of minister should be deleted there, Chair. Then, Chair, the definition national treasury means the national treasury established by Section 5 of the Public Finance Management Act. Organ of state means an organ of state as defined in Section 239 of the Constitution, 1996, but does not include the security services referred to in section 199 of the Constitution.
Stop there. Members, are we happy up to now?
Yes.
Can I just find out, do we refer anywhere anymore to the National Commissioner?
No.
In the bill?
No.
So why are we having a definition of the National Commissioner? Then we should remove the definition of the National Commissioner. Please.
Thank you, Chair. On page 10, Public Finance Management Act means the Public Finance Management Act 1999, Act No. 1 of 1999, and security business means subject to Section 20, brackets 5, any person who renders a security service to another for remuneration, reward, fee or benefit, except the person acting only as a security officer. Then on page...
The square bracket before the word subsection 2, is that going out and leaving in subsection 20? But we'd already made that change in the previous version. I just don't understand why it hasn't just been made here.
The square bracket means it's been deleted.
But Chair, it's because it's amending the present wording of the Act, so we need to indicate it on the bill as well.
Continue, please.
Thanks, Chair. The definition of security officer means any natural person, A1, who is employed by another person, including an organ of state, subject to Section 21A and B of the Act, and to receive, who is entitled to receive from such other person any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit for rendering one or more security services, or two, who assist in carrying on or conducting the affairs of another security service provider, and who receives or is entitled to receive from such other security service provider or any other person inserted any remuneration, reward, fee or benefit as regards one or more security services.
That members, continue.
Chair, the previous one we have discussed previously, manufacturing, assembling, that's E on page 12. Manufacturing, assembling, possessing, selling, purchasing or advertising of listed equipment contemplated in section 1 of the Regulation of Interception of Communication and Provision of Communication Related Information Act 2002, authorized by the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development under section 45(2) and section 46(1)(a)(2) of that act. The Z must come out there, Chair. In Chair, on page 13K, making a person or the services of a person available, whether directly or indirectly, for the rendering of any service referred to in paragraphs A to J, L and LA, to another person. L, managing, controlling or supervising the rendering of any of the services referred to in paragraphs A to J and LA. And LA, protecting or safeguarding of cash or goods with high value, including precious metals or jewelry, when transported on a public road, except when transported by a person at his or her own account, or by the South African National Defence Force, or in the case of transport by escort of the service. M, creating the impression in any manner that one or more of the services in paragraphs A to LA are rendered. And then, Chair, we have deleted in security service provider, in the second line, we've deleted that A. And Chair, that is the subsection that the Scholar Barnard referred to that has been deleted, subsection 2 on page 14.
Continue, are we satisfied, members? Continue.
Chapter 2, Chair, we have deleted subsection 2. The head of the authority is head office of the authority is situated in Pretoria, and then the consequential amendment of taking out the 1 as well. Objects of the authority, we've deleted in section 3, the interests of the private security industry itself, and then on page 15, Chair, it was to restructure the section, that whole part is being deleted, and then we start on page 16, with the insertion of paragraph 8, ensure a legitimate private security industry which, 1, acts in terms of the principles contained in the Constitution and other applicable law, 2, is characterized by ethical conduct, accessibility, accountability, transparency, equity, professionalism and stability, and 3, protects and serves the interests of members of the public who use or who are affected by security services. B, determine and enforce minimum standards of occupational conduct in respect of security service providers. C, ensure that the process of registration of security service providers is transparent, fair, objective and concluded timelessly. D, promote high uniform standards in the training of security service providers and prospective security service providers. E, promote the protection and enforcement of the rights of security officers and other employees in the private security industry. And then F, ensure that compliance with existing legislation by security service providers is being promoted and controlled through a process of active monitoring and investigation of the affairs of security service providers. G is deleted, and a new G is inserted, promote awareness amongst the public and the private security industry on the functions and role of the authority in the industry.
Honourable Quillen,
two little things on G, page 16. I think you need to put a comma after promote high, comma, uniform standards, because the way it reads right now, it means high uniform standards, which means standards of uniforms, as opposed to high uniform standards in training. So comma would have to go in there. And on 17G, should that not be private security industry in caps?
Chair, think so. No, I think it is. No, but there are instances where we refer to the private security industry there we as zero. They have been cut, but here we're talking about the business of private security. Yeah. But you can correct me if I'm wrong. Come on. Okay, can I go back, please? Page 60. After the word I. Please.
Thank you, Chair. Page 17, we have just inserted the in section 4B, inquire into and report to the Minister through the Council, the reporting line, and C, advise the Minister through the Council on any matter deemed by the authority to be necessary or expedient.
Can we continue?
Then, Chair, in terms of the option that the committee preferred in terms of section 4, we have deleted from E to page 19 up to and the following pages 21, etc. So we start again on page 22E, that's inserted. Receive and consider applications for registration and renewal of registration as security service provider and grant or renew registration to applicants who comply with the requirements for such registration or renewal of registration in terms of this Act. And Chair, regarding the renewal, we have made provision, or we will make provision in the transitional provisions for that as well. F, establish and manage offices for the authority in every province. G, provide or disseminate information promoting and encouraging compliance with this Act, the Levies Act and the Code of Conduct by security service providers. H, provide information to the users, prospective users or representatives of users of security services regarding the compliance of security service providers with the provisions of this Act and the Levies Act. I, in the prescribed manner, establish a complaints office to receive, process, refer or deal with complaints regarding unlawful or unethical conduct by security service providers. J, determine, charge and collect fees as provided for in this Act or in respect of any service rendered by the authority or any object made available by the authority. K, determine minimum internal control systems for security businesses, including but not limited to accounting and reporting procedures and any other procedures or systems. L, conduct or course to be conducted hearings, investigations and inquiries with regard to any matter falling within the scope of its functions. M, enter into agreements with or obtain the assistance of any department or organ of state to conduct or assist it in conducting any investigation or performing any other function in terms of this Act or the Levies Act. That is section 4 as reader of the chair.
No further.
Yeah, I think there just needs to be an and inserted at the end of L.
You just add that because we've now taken away N, so the A and would move up.
Page 23, JF, section 5. We've inserted 2A, the Public Finance Management Act applies to the Council. And in sub 4, the authority must otherwise perform its functions in terms of this Act, the Levies Act and the Public Finance Management Act. And 5A, the authority must perform its functions in accordance with such guidelines and policy directions as may be issued by the Minister from time to time by notice in the Gazette. Then sub 6, whenever members of the Council are unable to agree on a material, financial, governance or operational issue which cannot be resolved by the Council, the Minister must mediate between the parties.
Can I just check something. The Public Finance Management Act applies to this council, to the council. The authority, and then four, the authority must otherwise perform its functions in terms of this Act, and the Levies Act, and Public Finance Management Act. So it makes it clear that the Public Finance Management Act also applies to the authority. Okay. Honourable Stuba, Honourable Kulabana.
Then and four, just after this Act, shouldn't there be a comma, the Levies Act and?
It's actually a comma. I think it just didn't read it. After the and, there's a line with a comma. So there is a comma. Continue.
I thought perhaps there should be a comma after material. Number six, agree on a material, financial, governance, or operational issue. Or is it a material financial?
On page 24, section 6, sub 2, that was inserted. Subject to section 7, a member of the council for the authority must be a fit and proper person with due regard to his or her experience, conscientiousness and integrity to be entrusted with the responsibilities of the office concerned. 3, the members of the council must, when viewed collectively by persons who are suited, be persons who are suited to serve on the council by virtue of their qualifications, experience and expertise in the fields of finance, law and governance. The committee asks us to insert their qualifications. And sub 4, the minister must report to Parliament on the appointment of councillors as well as their qualifications, experience and expertise.
Can I hear you on this? Happy? Seems to it. Okay.
Chair, 7, we've already dealt with that. The removal of does not have permanent resident status, and that's in respect of the appointment of a councillor. And then on page 25, is not a fit and proper person to hold office as councillor. That C is deleted because it's already addressed on top. D is an unrehabilitated insolvent or is deleted. E has not obtained such a security clearance by the State Security Agency, as may have been determined by the minister, and then we insert or if has been convicted of a criminal offence or who is subject to a pending criminal prosecution.
Can I get clarity on E? Is E now saying the minister can determine whether it's necessary, or are we saying it is necessary to get security clearance?
Chair, as far as I have it, is that the minister can determine the level. There must be a security clearance, but the minister can determine the level. Such is a security clearance determined by the minister. In other words, the minister determined the nature of the, yeah.
To get clarity on that, anything else there, members? Continue then.
Section 8, Chair, insertion of subsection 1, a councillor, or it's an amendment of subsection 1, a councillor is, subject to this section, appointed for a period not exceeding 5 years, on such terms and conditions as the minister may determine in a letter of appointment, provided that all members of the council serve on a part-time basis. And then you've inserted in 2, a councillor is eligible for reappointment upon the expiry of his or her term of office for a period not exceeding 2 years if he or she continues to meet the requirements.
Are we happy with that? Continue.
Chair, sub 3 in C, we have deleted the or, and we've inserted or after D and then the new paragraph E. He or she is no longer a fit and proper person as required in Section 6A, and just to link that up, Section 3A, when a councillor becomes subject to any disqualification referred to in Section 7, or is absent from 3 consecutive meetings of the council, the chairperson, vice-chairperson or acting chairperson contemplated in Section 12.10, as the case may be, must inform the minister in writing within a reasonable time, but before the next meeting of council of such disqualification or absence. Subsection 5, Chair, if a councillor ceases to hold office, the minister must, with due regard to Section 6A and 7,
within 6 months appoint a person to fill the vacancy. 6, a councillor or a member of a committee appointed by the council referred to in section 13.1 who is not an employee of the authority or an officer or employee in the public service may be paid from the funds of the authority such remuneration and allowances as the minister may determine with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. N7 is deleted, Chair.
Are we satisfied with this? I think that's what we asked for. Continue.
Chair, page 27. Just to get the context, Chair, a councillor vacates office when, and on page 26E, he or she is no longer a fit and proper person as required in section 6.8. 3A, when a councillor becomes subject to any disqualification referred to in section 7 or is absent from 3 consecutive meetings of the council, the chairperson, vice chairperson or acting chairperson contemplated in section 12A, as the case may be, must inform the minister in writing within a reasonable time but before the next meeting of council of such disqualification or absence.
Should there not be a full stop and not a comma at the end there?
It should be a full stop, Chief.
On the top, E, and then 3A, when a council becomes subject. Can we continue? Are we satisfied with that? Continue then.
Section 5, Chief, if a councillor ceases to hold office, the minister must, with due regard to Section 6A and 7, within 6 months appoint a person to fill the vacancy. And 6, a councillor or a member of a committee appointed by the council referred to in section 13.1 who is not an employee of the authority.
Confusing us because you've read this already.
No, I realize that I said Chair. Thanks.
That way we picked up the full stop instead of the comma. Continue then, please. Honourable Kulabana.
I can't recall. Does it say somewhere, in other words, repeating, it's that same one you've read a few times now, 3A, that does it say somewhere that if a person misses 3 consecutive meetings, they're removed, there's something, what consequences are there? Because it's having to be reported on, but is there a consequence to it?
On the previous page, it clearly states there are 3 consecutive meetings.
Thank you, Chair. C, may in consultation with the Minister by notice in the Gazette make rules subject to the provisions of this Act, comma, the Levies Act and the Public Finance Management Act regarding 1, the good management of the affairs of the Council and the effective execution of its functions and 2, any matter necessary or expedient for the proper performance of the functions of the authority. 1A, in formulating the rules referred to in subsection 1C, cognizance must be taken of the principles relating to improvement of service delivery, quality of training and integrity as applicable to the public administration. So you will recall that was the observation made by the Secretary. We will look at the PAM legislation and this was taken from the PAM bill that will be submitted to Parliament soon.
We just see may make in consultation with the Minister by notice and gazette rules. Shouldn't it be a must? I mean, this should be the primary job of the council. Should it not be a must? I'm asking, I'm not saying it must be.
You can make it a must, Chair, maybe.
Instead of may, it becomes must. Yeah. Please.
Thank you, Chair. We have deleted in subsection 2 the provision that the chairperson may, subject to ratification by the council, exercise any power of the council or fulfill any of its duties. Then in D, the chair must provide strategic direction to the authority through the council. Then we have deleted E, may attend meetings of the senior management of the staff of the authority, and that is to make the division between the council and the authority. And F, must maintain a working relationship with the civilian secretariat
to cooperate on policing and policy matters relating to the private security industry.
Satisfied with that? No complaints, continue.
Chair, page 2810, the Council is accountable to the Minister for the performance of its functions and must supply the Minister with such information and particulars as the Minister may in writing require in connection with the functions of the authority or any other matter relating to the authority. Then 1A is inserted. The Council must submit a report to the Minister, A, on any matter required by the Minister under subsection 1, and on any matter necessary or expedient to bring to the attention of the Minister, and B, at least once a quarter in connection with the activities of the authority, including on the number of security service providers registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended, dormant, merged, deaccredited, and prosecuted, to the number of security officers registered, including category and functions, three, the details of training undertaken by registered security officers and training institutions, four, the number of training institutions registered, sold, transferred, liquidated, suspended, and dormant, five, the number of firearms registered to, lost by, stolen from, transferred by security businesses or destroyed in terms of the Firearms Control Act, 60 of 2000. Six instances in which firearms were discharged by a security officer in the performance of his or her duties causing death or injury. Seven, information of criminal complaints and investigations relating to security service providers reported to the service by the authority. Eight, the number of meetings of the council. And then inserted also nine, a report in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, and ten, a monthly report on AA, the financial performance of the authority, and BB, any deposits or withdrawals relating to any investment account of the authority and the reasons therefore. And then subsection 2 is deleted. Chair, the AA and BB was reformulated in terms of request of the committee.
We check, make sure that it's in line with the PFMA, and I think that is covering it. Can I see members? Are you satisfied? Okay, continue, please. It's 12:30. I wonder whether we shouldn't continue here after lunch, the ministerial supervision of the authority. We can continue on page 30. Members, where are we meeting after lunch? Okay, members, we are meeting here for the time being after lunch, which means if the bells ring, you will have to run. Good exercise for all of us. What is your problem, Secretary? We have to talk about certain issues. I'm not worried about time. So what I would suggest is that we be back here. We can have an hour and a half lunch. Members haven't had time to go to the offices last week or this week. That we start again at 2 o'clock so that members have enough time now to do some of their personal administration and things that they need to do. And we get back here at 2 o'clock exactly we start. Hopefully, we would be in a position to actually be done before voting starts in the House. I think we might be in a position to be done before voting starts in the House. So can we agree on that, members? Okay. Meeting adjourned. Thank you. We are going to ask them to come and lock this venue. So if you want to leave your stuff here, you can do so. We're going to ask them to come and lock the venue. So if you want to leave your stuff here, you can do so.
They will be lunch around 1 o'clock.